KM Football Podcast. Exclusive interviews with the biggest names in Kent football.
Welcome to this week's KM Football Podcast. I'm your host Matthew Panting, and I'm joined by Craig Tucker of the KM Sports Desk. Our guest this week has rubbed shoulders with the likes of Jose Mourinho, Patrick Vieira, Mario Balotelli and Terry Butcher. He came to prominence by winning Football's Next Star, a reality TV show where the prize was a six-month deal with Italian giants Inter Milan. He originally started at Welling and has also featured for the likes of Ebbsfleet, Maidstone and Dartford. His travels have also taken in Inverness in Scotland and Concord Rangers in sunny Essex. But he's currently out on loan at Tunbridge Angels, where he scored in his debut last week. So it's a warm welcome to the podcast to our guest this week, Ben Greenhow.
Thank you very much. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Good to see you, Ben. Thanks for coming in. We'll start with Tunbridge. Cup tied or not allowed to play in the trophy at the weekend, first of all?
Yeah, I wasn't allowed, understandably, because obviously the home club is Dartford and they had Maidstone. If they then go through, they don't want to put themselves in a difficult situation where I can't play. So it was understandable. It was frustrating to sit on the side because on a Saturday you want to be playing football. And the boys did really well, though. It was a really good game and they showed good spells in the game of playing against a side that I think had won 8 games on the spin. So it was a good result.
Yeah, you marked your debut with Tunbridge with a cheeky little free kick I saw as well from the edge of the box. And that was a big win, wasn't it, against St Albans?
It was. When I went in, I didn't really know how many points Tunbridge were on. I knew they were down at the bottom, but it was surprising because when we played them for Dartford, they did really well. And I was surprised to see how little points they had. I spoke to Steve about it and he just said they'd let in a lot of late goals and they dropped a lot of points in the last 5 to 10 minutes of games. And interestingly enough, and hopefully it was a bit of a turning point, it nearly happened to us again that week. St Albans scored with about 3 minutes to play. And then it becomes a very nervy sort of 3 minutes, but it was a massive 3 points, got us off the bottom of the league, and it's something that we can try and improve on and hopefully, a turning point.
Yeah, what have you made of Tunbridge? I mean, you've obviously played against them this season for Dartford. You've only played that one game, but you also watched them at the weekend. False position, would you say, from what you've seen just in those limited snapshots?
Yeah, definitely. But there's probably a lot of clubs like that in this league. A lot of clubs can go and beat anyone. I feel like we almost say that every year, that you can lose to the bottom, you can beat the top. But I feel like this year, a lot of the lower clubs are playing some nice football and it's very surprising when you turn up there. I think looking back 4 or 5 years ago, when you were playing in the league, you sort of knew when you were going to get a result and you probably knew you didn't have to turn up as much. But now every team's on it and a lot of games are really difficult. But it's definitely a false position for them. Like I said, they play some really nice football. And it was great to be a part of. I think the first half against St Albans, they can get out of their half. And we were just playing in and around them. And it was some really good football. So it hopefully, if that can carry on and we can keep scoring the goals and not letting in the goals, then I'm sure we'll start climbing the table.
You've glossed over your free kick. We'll let you indulge in it for a moment. Talk us through it. You were quite close in as well. So it's one of those where you've got to get it over and you can't hit it too quick, can you?
No, to be honest, I was saying in an interview 2 weeks ago, I actually quite like that type of free kick. I like a one-step run-up, a little curly one over the wall. I think if I look back on a lot of my free kicks, they've probably all been from right on the edge of the area. So it was definitely one that I looked at when I got it. I was very confident and it was in a great position to have the free kick. And obviously, I was luckily enough that it went in the top corner and scored the goal.
Obviously, a change of manager at Dartford, it's almost prompted the loan spell. We've not really figured a great deal under Steve King. Was it you that requested to go out on loan?
Yeah, it was a little bit. Yeah, I mean, I'd spent 2 games of not being in the squad, so I gave Steve a call and we chatted and we thought maybe it was a good idea for this month to go and get a loan spell in. To be fair, over the years, I've spoke to Steve really well. We've had really good chats. So it was quite easy to talk to. It was quite easy to find out what was wanted. Not 100% sure on what the plans are for the future. I don't know. But all at the moment I can do is go and play for this month and do as well as I can. Enjoy my time at Tunbridge Angels, which I am doing, and then see what happens come a week and a half's time.
Are you open to staying at Tunbridge for longer?
I'm open to it. I mean, my home club in my head is Dartford. I work for Dartford. I love the club. Yeah, I think the best outcome would be coming back to Dartford, but then at the same time I'd feel a little bit gutted to leave Tunbridge because I get along with the boys so well. It's a really good change room, really good atmosphere, and it's something that I'm enjoying every week and I want to be more of a part of it. And like I said, I like the way they play football. They've got me in the 10 at the moment, sort of getting on the ball as much as possible, and it's definitely something I'm enjoying again. So it's difficult, but it's the way the world of football is. Sometimes you're loving it somewhere, sometimes you're not liking it as much, and you've got to make really tough decisions that you never know of which one's going to be the best decision.
What have you made of Steve King's impact at Dartford? It seems to have turned things around, or almost built on what Tony Berman had started.
Yeah, I mean, it was difficult for Flan and Coyley. I get along with them both really well. They had a really good changing room, just the results weren't going their way. And looking back on it, I'm not sure I can even put something on why that was, but confidence seemed a bit low, and it was another similar thing to Tunbridge. We were just letting in a lot of goals, and that's not because of the defence. As a team, we just seemed to be a little bit out of shape. Tony Berman came in and he did one training session with us about us just being more compact, getting up quicker, keeping the pitch a lot smaller, and it did make a difference. And I think the changing room, it's sad in some ways, because new managers do come in and then they do make an impact. It does happen with Tony Berman straight away, that level of respect was there for Tony because of what he's done for the club. You saw the experienced boys who had obviously played under him, very happy to play under him again. Sad, like I'm saying, for Flan and Coyley, that results did then start turning around, but Tony Berman definitely got us going, and he got a lot of confidence out of players towards the end when we started picking up good results. He got us into nearly round one in the FA Cup, got us into the fourth qualifying round, and also in the league, I think we picked up a couple of good three-pointers, so away from home, which was a big thing. And like you're saying, Steve King's come in and he's got maybe 8 points, is it, in four games? So it's definitely a points tally that the club need to have. So that's massive for the club, and hopefully, yeah, can keep building on it.
I've seen since you went to Tunbridge that there's been quite a good reaction from some of the Dartford fans who have backed your play and thought how well you've done for the club. So that must be quite pleasing to read some of that.
Yeah, it's heartwarming. I get along with the Dartford fans really well. I've always gone and spoken to, always try to give it as much time as I can to talk to them, because I think they understand that I only want the club's what's best for the club, and that I want to be playing out at Prince's Park. I want to do it every week. I really enjoy it. The amount of my young academy teams that I come and bring over to Dartford and show them, and I've let them be mascots, or they've come and played against the pre-academy and things. It's just a club that's really good to be involved with. I think they know at the same time I had played quite well last year and I'd put in a lot of effort, and I think that's one thing they like, that they've loved Lee Noble down there for years, because what he does, he runs about everywhere and you'll find him anywhere on the pitch. So it's one thing that I sort of thought, I'm not going to go out there and just try and see if I can show my abilities. I'm just going to go and put absolute maximum effort in, and I think the fans bought to that, which is really good.
I was just going to say one more thing on Dartford. I remember chatting to you when you signed for him, and you said that I think Tony Berman had tried to sign you several times before. Yeah. So he finally got to manage you, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I mean, it's quite funny. We always had a joke about that. I think he rang me a few times. There was one time that I came down the year before I went to Maidstone in the Ryman Premier. I came down and I had a little knock on my leg, and it was the way that non-league works. You can't give a player a contract. You can't offer a player this if they're injured, because you end up putting your own club in jeopardy, basically. So that was a different. I think had I not been injured, then I might have signed that year, and it might have been a different story. But and then it was a couple of years later after the Concord season. I think even after the Maidstone season, we sort of spoke. But it's difficult that time of year. Your phone starts ringing at the start of June, at the start of May, sorry, and you want to have made your decision by June. You want to make a decision where you're going to be. I'm always like, well, I want to know where I am, know where I'm going to be, go on holiday, relax, get fit for pre-season and go again. And I think those other two times, Tony was just a little bit too late. I'd committed to another club, and maybe had he come in a little bit earlier, that I probably would have signed again. So it was more bad luck rather than not wanting to be there. But as soon as Flam rang about Dartford this time round, it was a definite yes. It was what I was looking forward to. Didn't even discuss money. But I just said yes straight away. I'm going to sign.
We've got to take you back then to football's next star. That's what you know. I was watching a clip on YouTube, and Jamie Redknapp was saying whoever wins this show is going to change their life forever. So has it?
Yeah, it did. It did, definitely, because mainly from an experience point of view. I say to everyone, had the show been in England, might have been a little bit more lucky, because I was out there in the end for nearly 2 years, and everyone sort of, they forget about you, because let's be honest, I wasn't playing for Inter Milan first team, so no one's going to be seeing that. And then when I went on loan to Como in Serie C, no one follows Italian football in England again. So it was all good for me in Italy, but I think deep down I wanted to play football in England. So it was difficult coming back. They were going to do the show again with Man City, and I feel like had they done the show with Man City and someone had gone and won for Man City, I think people would keep an eye on it a lot more. And we know a lot more that's going on with Man City's reserves and Man City's under-18. So I think you'd be able to see it a little bit more. But it's definitely changed my life. I think more for an experience, because, let's be honest, I was lucky enough to see all of them great players play under Jose Mourinho. It's almost surreal saying it now. So at the time, I was stuck on it. I didn't even think about it. If I walked past Mourinho in the corridor, I wouldn't think anything of it. But when I look back at it now, you just realise how surreal that whole moment was.
Yeah, because I saw a picture, I think you shaking hands with him on the training ground, and then you watch that picture as Patrick Vieira is tracking you on the training ground. And you just sort of look at those pictures and think, blimey, you know.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm actually surprised myself thinking about it now, because if I was to walk past Vieira now, suddenly I'd be like a little bit starstruck. And for some reason, I don't know what it was, maybe I was just in the zone and I just wanted to prove everyone and prove myself. The only one time I got starstruck was the first time I trained with the first team, got the ball out on the left, Quaresma's just passed the ball to me. I've then got my head up, looked to run at the right back, and I've looked up and I've seen Lucio, one of the quickest Brazilian defenders in football. And I remember my legs just went to jelly and just completely kicked it off the pitch. And I think that was the only time I was really starstruck. I was lucky enough to the next day go and train with them again. And just, again, like I said, surprised myself. I felt normal, felt natural, ended up nutmegging Vieira. So it was an unbelievable experience. But it was good. Surprising that as 17-year-olds, didn't get starstruck, didn't want to almost just pictures of this stuff like this. I think we didn't have Twitter and things like that at the time, so I wasn't constantly on social network saying about what happened here, what happened there. I was just living in Italy, head down, focused on everything, and felt so normal. The stories now feel completely out of the blue or something really strange. But it was a really good time of my life, and I think it's something that I try and say to all my academy boys now. Just sums up how a little bit of effort, if you've got the right mentality, things can go your way.
Did Vieira get you back for nutmegging him?
No, he didn't. To be fair, he didn't. I was a little bit. We on our final episode of Football's Next Star. That was that training session, and I actually did an interview with Patrick Vieira, and it went on for quite a few minutes, and it had him saying that I'd done really well in training, and he said he was going to look out for me in the academy. So I was a little bit gutted when the show aired that interview never came about. I think had it come about, it might have shown I was more likely to be the winner. So I understand why, from a TV purposes, they didn't do it. But it's something that I would like to see, and maybe held on to this day. Like you said, my WhatsApp picture's still me and Vieira. So I think one of the best sentiments ever, and I was lucky enough to train with him.
Yeah, I mean, to go back, I think, is it 7,000 applicants?
Yeah,
to get down to one,
I think it might have been more. I thought it got into the tens of thousands. It was around that, but it was Ken Brook that got me in. I'm sure you've seen Ken Brook about the Kent FA, and he got our team down. And I was at the time, was Alex Fisher was in the team, Tom Phipps in the team, Carl Dent was in the team, and he just took us down to the what was the first episode. We had no idea what it was. We just got on this coach, thought it was a training session. Got down there, and suddenly there's cameras everywhere. There's a lot of Football's Next Star signs. We didn't really buy into it because we were sort of just, there's a lot of random people with there as a team just having a laugh. And I was lucky enough that a few of the coaches just spotted me. We were only doing drills, like dribbling drills and passing drills, and he spotted me and managed to put me through to the final game. I think Flish was in the final game as well. So it was me and Flish that sort of got through out of the Kent FA lot. That's where Redknapp was watching. And I think that it does just sum up how football can be that little bit of luck, because had I not had that luck to get into that game, then the whole Football's Next Star thing doesn't happen at all. Or if I didn't have that luck to maybe have a quite good game where Redknapp was watching, then again, the same sort of thing wouldn't have happened. And I was lucky enough to play well in that game, and I was the one that got through on that day. And because of that, ended up going to the final four in things, and James Redknapp was talking to me. And he, after that one little game that he saw, he gave me his number. He was ringing me. I was at Welling at the time. We were having issues whether I was going to be playing for the first team, because there was also a chance of going to Italy in 2 weeks' time. So and he was giving me a lot of advice on that, and I think it proves that something can just go from doing well for Kent FA and things like this, playing for Welling, to suddenly jumping up loads of steps just from that little bit of luck. If that one person's watching in football and you have the good game, then they can buy into you and take you from there.
It's crazy. Talking of Redknapp, there was talk of Spurs as well. Obviously, Harry was there at the time, wasn't he? There was a sort of possibility of perhaps going there if the interview hadn't worked out.
I think, like I said earlier, I think had that happened, I can't say I would have had a more successful professional career in England, but it's probably got more likely because, again, people would see you playing at Tottenham. I remember I went to Watford before the Inter Milan thing, before the whole programme came out. We had a sort of a three-month period where I couldn't go and sign for them. So I had 3 months. We went and played for Watford. We went to the training ground at Tottenham, and it was unbelievable. I met Harry Redknapp and things. And it was one of them. I was so focused on playing for Inter Milan. I'd won this contract that if you had your head screwed on, or if you had someone that you really knew within football quite high up who was experienced enough to tell you the right decision, then maybe you go, right, I think I should stay at Tottenham for 2 years. I'm a lot more local to home. You're not just a 17-year-old chucked in the sticks of Italy where no one can speak any English. So maybe it could have been a better opportunity, but who knows? Who knows? And I don't regret anything. I'd still do things the same way. It's just one of them in football. Sometimes one avenue takes you to a different path. So,
was it part of the show, though, that you had to take the Inter deal? Or was it literally, you know, you could have chosen to say, no, I don't want to go to Italy, I'm going to get homesick, I want to play for Tottenham? I
probably could have said that, because at the end of the day, I think the show got what they needed. Because, like I said, I think people did watch the show and then, like, where am I now? And I was at Inter Milan, so maybe that helped. But I don't think people really pursued the story after that. I think once the TV show stopped, it'll be like X Factor. Every year you go like, where's the winner from X Factor gone? You forget about them a little bit, and you hear that one-off single or something like that, and you start going, oh, that's where they are. What have they done since? And doesn't really pay attention in your mind of what's going on. But I don't think it would have ruined the show if I hadn't have gone. But it obviously helped them out to say, look, he is at Inter Milan. We did do this. But from points of view of the show, I think if I was to look back on it and ever work in TV or anything like that, I think what they could have done better was not look after me while I was out there, but realistically they did just chuck me out there. And you were just a 17-year-old completely chucked out, and they never really followed up on anything. Maybe if there had been a Footballs Next Star 2, they might have come back out and checked how I was and things like that. But I think, yeah, they could have done that a little bit better. But at the end of the day, their job was to get viewers, and they got a lot of viewers. I was surprised how many viewers were watching it. I think it competed with Strictly Come Dancing or something on the final episode. So that's quite a big one.
I'll talk about football in Italy in a minute. Just one thing that does strike me, though, is so you had a bit of a choice, really, in a way, which we've probably looked over, but it's probably a hard choice for many people. So you could have played for Welling and turned down the TV show and the chance of playing for Jose Mourinho Inter Milan.
Yeah.
And stayed at Welling and just played for Welling.
Yeah.
And you bizarrely went for the TV show.
Yeah.
I mean, what was going through your mind?
I think when you're a kid, you're a dreamer, aren't you? So if you get the opportunity to do anything, you do it, and you don't really think anything through. But again, if I'd have got the bad advice, or if I'd have been really sucked into it, I could have been on this contract at Welling, and then they didn't let me go. There were a lot of rumours that the international clearance was taking a while. I don't know the truth behind it. There were a lot of rumours that someone at Welling was trying to get a bit of money out of Inter Milan. But as soon as you hear that big club come in, it's understandable. But it did... I probably spent 2 or 3 months not being able to play. And I'm not saying that's Welling's fault whatsoever, but international clearance is a nightmare. And we've had to do it with some of the academy boys at Dartford, and it can take months just to try and get it done. But once it was done in the end, I sort of got my head down. And because it was difficult, because first of all, you are out in this country, and then you're not even allowed to go and play in the games. So we're waiting till a Sunday to play in the game, and I couldn't even plan it. So I'm just training a week. And that's definitely one of the hardest things in football. I've had times at clubs where I know I'm not in the squad. So you're just training, but you haven't really got an end goal. And that's why, in some ways, that's why the whole Tunbridge Angels thing came about, because I knew I needed to be playing games. And if you're not aiming to play a game, so aiming to do something in a match, then training becomes a little bit more difficult as well.
the latest reaction and reports from the games that matter, visit our website at kentonline.co.uk.
Talk about the lifestyle in Italy and the football in Italy. Did it fit Ben Greenow quite well? Was it, would the two go hand in hand?
It fitted the 17-year-old Ben Greenow, that's for sure. Found myself in Dolce & Gabbana shoes within 2 weeks, and then I realised about a month or two in that I've been sucked into it. But it's funny because, same in any path of life, if you're around certain people, you end up doing what those certain people do. And I was sharing rooms with Marko Arnautovic, and Mattia Destro is playing in Italy, and a few other boys that were from Serbia, one from Romania, really good friends with one from Sweden. And they're obviously, they've come over and they're earning this big money. And I'm not saying they're from bad backgrounds or anything, but they've just come into this money, and there's no advice. There's no advice for what they're going to spend it on. And I remember one boy was sending about 2,000-3,000 back home every month, and then the rest would just go on Louis Vuitton, Dolce & Gabbana, all of this. And I was just, because everyone's wearing it, I'd go and get one pair of trainers, but I was never stupid enough to go, right, I'm going to blow everything as well. Because I was lucky enough that I came from an all right background, where I was used to not having loads of nice stuff, but just used to being able to maybe get a pair of trainers or living in a reasonably nice house and things like this. So it was strange, and yeah, I did end up getting sucked into it. You end up going out in Milan, and it's a strange lifestyle in Milan though, because everyone is doing that. They all live in apartments, and then suddenly they're driving a Lamborghini. So I mean, the Inter Milan chairman lived above a shop. He had the whole apartment above a shop. But it's just obviously where we're used to over here, having these houses and a different way of life. I think that was the hardest thing for me at the time. It's just the lifestyle was so different. It's really different. Everything was cafes and things like that. And probably you wouldn't even see, not saying I needed a pub, but you'd never see a pub in Milan. You'd never just see a really friendly sort of nice place to go to. So it was different. Having said that, I remember at the time I don't think I had alcohol at all in Italy, because they didn't do cider, and I like my cider. I'm not really a beer drinker, and just little things like that. It's funny though, looking back at it now, it plays on your mind. It does play on your mind. And I also feel when I was at Inter Milan, because all these boys were Eastern European, they spoke good English. So we found ourselves in this group of the boys that weren't Italian that all spoke English to each other. So the first 6 months was at Inter Milan, I barely learned any Italian, barely learned anything. And we were going to Italian lessons, but it's completely different. You're learning grammar, you're not learning actually how to have a day-to-day conversation. And when I went on loan to Como, that was chucked in the deep end, because then I'm living in an apartment with all Italians who can't speak any English at all. They'll try and say a few words, but it's nowhere near what you'd imagine. And it was just, yeah, it's funny how language works like that. I suppose it's like when you're a baby and you're born and you learn how to speak. I just, for some reason, within a month, just completely picked it up. And it was definitely a better experience. Once I learned the Italian, I then understood Italians a lot more. I then got to grips with the way that Italian life was. And I think I was 18 by that time. And it was something that I started to grow up on me a little bit.
Have you still got it in your locker now?
Still got it in the locker now, yeah. I mean, it's quite funny. If I'm ever up in London or anything, there's a few Italians and things. I always try it on a night out, but it's a difficult language to keep going. It really is a difficult language because they speak so fast. I remember I could always have a really good conversation with anyone, but as soon as you watch TV or listen to the radio, you're just lost, because it just flies away and you're there in your head trying to pick up the language. I think what was funny is I started thinking in Italian. I think that's when I really got the language. When I started thinking in my own head to myself, I'm talking Italian in my head. And that was when you knew that it was almost my first language at that time. And every time I spoke English to anyone Eastern European in Italy, I'd put on an accent. I couldn't talk in my own voice. I'd talk in an English way that they would understand. And I think that was the hardest thing. I remember doing, I did like a little interview for an Italian newspaper out there, and he was speaking in English to me because he felt I'd get the best answers back. Luckily, it was only written down, it wasn't recorded, but I was doing the same thing. I was doing the same thing, making these weird soundings for my voice, and I felt I couldn't talk normally at all because I was so used to speaking Italian.
Talk to us about Mourinho then. He's obviously making headlines again in the Premier League. What was he like? How much interaction did you have at that time?
He was good at that time. I think I was probably lucky enough to see Mourinho at his highest point. I think Inter Milan for Mourinho's, he's probably got to say that's the best year in his career because he won the treble. He did have a good team, but realistically, I wouldn't say they were world beaters. I wouldn't say they were the best team in the Champions League. And it was funny seeing these players come in every day, and they just had so much respect for him. It was like an awe to him that anyone walk about, they'd go and say anything to him. The only person that didn't was Balotelli. And I'm sure he's had that for a few managers. I remember he came on in the semi-final. I think it was Inter Milan Barcelona. He came in the semi-final of the Champions League with 30 minutes to go, which I think he was 22 maybe, for 21, 22-year-old, is still quite a high point in your career to be coming on semi-final Champions League and ended up winning I'm not sure we won the game, but went through to the final. And he's completely lost his head and he's going about storming about, everyone's cheering, and he's storming about annoyed that he didn't start the game. He's taken his kit off, spat on his kit and threw it into the fans. And just thinking, just a lot of things that he'd do like that. He was probably the only one that Mourinho, he got him playing well, but he couldn't get the right mentality out of him. He was probably the only one that didn't respect Mourinho as much as what he deserved at that time. There was another time he went into Milan in an AC Milan kit and was just walking around petrol stations asking for people to have pictures with him. And he's just thinking, for the rivalry that Milan and Inter Milan have, is crazy. So the stuff he would do and the stuff he'd get away with, it was a strange one. But all the other players just were in awe of Mourinho. So he'd always be smiling. He wouldn't take the training, but he'd turn up 10 minutes in, he'd walk about, come and chat to us. And it was just, he seemed more relaxed than probably what he was at United and Tottenham. He seemed like he had that charisma again, and it wasn't too much arrogance because he was proving it on the pitch, and he got the most out of the team to go and win the Coppa Italia, to win the league and win the Champions League. And it was sort of, you look at the final, it's probably the most boring final you'll ever see. They won 2-0, but it's just what he did, and he got the most out of these players. Diego Milito had that one-off year. Diego Milito was probably the best player in the world that year. And then it proves that next year under Benitez, Milito isn't as good. And it was just down to management. So you've got to give it to him and say what a year he had. And he's done it at other clubs as well. Whether it's going to be sustainable enough anymore at Tottenham, we'll see. But he's definitely, if he gets the right players inside and they respect him, then he's probably the best manager in the world.
What were your conversations like with him then? When he talked to you on the training ground, was there things you thought, yeah, actually you're spot on there?
It was what I like from him, and it's not just from him that I've learnt that. I've learnt that from a lot of other managers, and it's something that I try and do in coaching. He was very positive, really positive. Maybe there were a few players that he didn't talk to because they weren't in his plans. That happens with managers. You just got to accept that. But I think all the other players he was really positive to. And he'd tell them what they're good at. He'd tell them what they need to do. He'd tell them what their future should hold. And that's what he'd come and say it to me. He said, he was to me, he just said, from here, you can only go up. Just enjoyment can only go up. He said, realistically, he didn't say it in this way, but I knew it. I was never going to play for the Inter Milan first team. But he was saying, wherever your career takes you, just keep going up, keep enjoying it, keep doing what you do, keep showing what you can do. And that's all you can do as a player. And I think to hear that from a manager that you've looked at on TV and you're not intimidated by, but you have this almost fear of him because of how respected he is and how well he's done within football. To hear that sort of positivity from someone like that, it definitely helped me out while I was there.
When you look at it now, the one thing that strikes me is obviously there was a TV programme, someone had to win. The prize was always going to be 6 months at Inter. But the fact that you actually then got another contract from them, is that the bit that actually says, hold on a minute, it was actually, you deserved that bit. That was the bit that, there was no TV show there on that extra year, was there? You know, so you actually did do something to earn that.
Yeah, I mean, it was not surprising, but it was a little bit, that's when you go, right, I'm now a proper Inter Milan player. I'm not just this TV show winner playing with the academy boys. And that was something, that was pretty amazing, really, because I'd gone from playing for they're under 18s, so they're under 21s as well. So that's that sort of step happened. So a lot of things went forward. It was one of them. It's Benitez came in at the time as well. And I reckon if I didn't go on loan, there's a chance I could have properly featured for the first team, because that year he was having to bring in all the reserves. He was having to bring in the under 21s because everyone was injured. No one was really wanting to play for Benitez. So all these players like Eto, Melito, who had done so well the year before, Schneider, they sort of stopped playing a little bit. They weren't playing very well. They didn't really look up for it. I think it must be difficult being a new manager coming to a team where they've just won everything. You've almost got everything to lose. You can't really go and smash the job again, because how'd you beat that previous season? So it was one of those things where, I mean, one of the boys, Ali Bek Dennis, was one of the boys I shared a room with. He ended up playing about 6 or 7 games for the first team. I felt a lot more part of it, and I felt a lot more part of the club. And yeah, there was definitely a difference in it. I was no longer this game show winner standing in the room with everyone. I was actually an academy player, and I felt like I could say hello to everyone a bit easier. Felt a bit more natural at the club, and felt you could enjoy yourselves a bit more.
So when it came to making the decision to come back, how did that happen? And
yeah, I mean, it was Christmas time, I think 2010, 2011, around then. And I was at Como, I'd just finished my loan. And they'd said to me, they wanted me to stay, but they couldn't agree a deal. Mainly because they'd offered me this money, which I would have signed for. But the boys in the first team hadn't received any money for 4 months. And it was the whole, where there were scandals going on in Italy. I'm sure you remember match fixing. We had a guy come into us and said, we need to draw the game. And it was, as an English person, just I was completely lost in it, because obviously we've got all this passion for football and everything like that. And to hear someone come in and say, we need to draw this game, and felt like that you couldn't go out on the pitch and play properly. I felt like it was, in the end, there was no agreement to draw in the game, but we did draw the game. So I'm not sure, maybe other players have been. I personally, no one actually came to me going, you definitely have to draw the game in the end. It was sort of something that was said before. Maybe other players had, I'm not saying taken money for it, but maybe there was something there, and the game was drawn. So I look back at it and go, you know what, maybe the two goalies were on it. I think it was a 1-1 draw. Maybe the two goalies were part of it, but it was all going downhill with Italian football. The crowds had completely gone. You think, for home games for Man United, for Liverpool, ground will always be full. We'd turn up to the San Siro sometimes, where we'd sit in our bit of the stand for the academy boys, and the whole top tier was completely empty. And it was strange to see that all the grounds were empty for most games, unless it was a big game. So the support wasn't quite there. Obviously the match fixing money was struggling within the football. So it was one of them, if I was an Italian kid and my family was out there, then yeah, it was like a no-brainer. I'd stay in San Como. I was playing well, I was enjoying it. But because I'd have to pay for my living, I'd have to pay for my food, I'd have to pay to be out there, it was completely different. You're then thinking, well, if I'm getting no money, how am I going to do this? Yeah. So it was a pretty easy decision, really, to go, while this is going on, I can't stay here. I'm going to have to go back. And like we said earlier, when you jump back after being away for a year and a half, it was quite difficult. It's almost like starting again. But yeah, maybe if I don't know, if that match fixing wasn't going on, if the whole money issues weren't a problem, I could have definitely seen myself staying out there. And there were a few Serie B, sort of Serie C clubs knocking on the door. So yeah, it could have been different, but it's another one of them. You've got to take it as it comes and just try and make the right decision at the time.
Yeah. So was that a club official who came in and said, we've got to draw this game then? Or?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I won't say any names in case this gets all the way to Italy. But it was... It was someone that came in and said, we need to draw the game. And I remember just looking around the change room and everyone just being a little bit confused. Maybe some of the boys were part of it, but I remember thinking, what is going on here? And you look back at David Platt's story. David Platt was saying, when he played out there, they got asked for a 0-0 draw. And he went back to him and said, I'm not doing that. And they came back in and said, right, 2-2 draw, you're going to score 2 goals. So obviously, stuff like that was going on. And I think the only club that really didn't get affected by it or weren't part of it were Inter Milan. I think I remember Juventus went down, didn't they? A lot of the other clubs went down because of it. And it does make you think that that sort of stuff, you hope it's not, but it does go on in football. And I'm sure there were a lot of issues in non-league football as well. I remember one of the first games for Eversley, I think they used to do on a betting company, first throw. And obviously, there's a great chance in giving away a first throw. As long as you win the kickoff, you end up booming it out of the ground, the other team's going to get the first throw. So there was a lot of things we were talking about then, saying I think some clubs are kicking it out of the ground on purpose and they might be part of it. So it's sad, really, that that sort of stuff goes on. I don't think it does happen in England as much, but there are people. You saw the whole Allardyce things and stuff like that, didn't you? I'm sure there are people that try and make a bit of money out of it because of how much money's in the game.
It'd probably shock people to sort of hear that when you sort of talk about non-league football, yeah, in this country, that could even be, yeah, stuff, I mean, like that going on.
I had an agent come up to me saying, do you know any dodgy goalkeepers who are willing to let the ball in? And it's just this sort of thing is people are trying this. People are trying to get somewhere with this because at the end of the day, there's a lot of people out there that just think about the pound note. So, and I'm sure there might be some goalkeepers that aren't too bothered about their own careers and they think, look, if I'm going to make a bit of money here, I'll let in that goal. I've never been part of a team other than maybe that one game. I've never been part of a team that, or any players, I've never known any players that I've played with have been onto things like that. But yeah, there are things that go on with any type of football. I'm sure there's going to be people that try and sort of take a little shortcut and get away with things.
I suppose in Italy particularly, you'd be perhaps scared of the repercussions if you don't follow instructions or whatever.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, imagine if I'd scored the winner at 2-1. who knows what would have happened. But yeah, I mean, talking of being scared, we had where I didn't understand the language, the two managers I played for out there, it was completely something else. Completely something else. One guy would just stare. I remember his eyes now. Just the way he'd look at you, just completely stare through you. And when I went on loan to Como, my first training session, obviously I couldn't speak the language very well at the time. We're doing a drill where it's throw it into your chest and just pass it back. For some reason, he's come up to me to do the drill. I'm holding the ball. He says, throw it to my chest. I throw it to his foot. Didn't know what he was saying. Throw it to his foot. He volleys it back at me. I was like, okay. Right, I'll go. He says, go again. And he shouts it a bit louder this time. Throw it at his foot again. Ends up volleying it right back at my face. And we end up walking off to somewhere else. We do a different drill. And I'm standing there going, I've got no idea what's going on. One of the boys was also on loan from Inter with me. And I was just like, what is this? And he was just like, yeah, don't worry about it. But looking back on it, it's funny. I think there's probably, not saying it's an Italian style, but quite a few Italian managers you look at, like Sarri and things like that, there's definitely the way that they are is very passionate and quite aggressive, quite scary. But when you're in their good books, I ended up playing well for Como and being in his good books. He was one of the nicest managers I've ever known. But to think that there's a lot of the way that they act, again, like, I think the word is passionate. It's something that I wouldn't do as a coach myself, because I remember thinking at the time, yeah, like you're saying, there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of fear in these managers, and you end up not wanting to do things just in case, maybe not showing your stuff on the pitch just in case you're in a changing room afterwards and he's throwing things at you or booting footballs at you again.
You're listening to the KM Football Podcast.
So I think it was not long after you're back, or eventually you ended up at Maidstone, didn't you? Briefly, yeah. First time round?
It was three spells, wasn't it? Trying to work out they always saying. I came back after Eversley, and I'd just gone up to Inverness. Inverness had sort of come in for me, so I went up there training. I'd agreed to sign for them, but again, the clearance issue, so I couldn't play for that season. So I remember while that was going on in between, I was sort of playing a few games for Maidstone in the Ryman South, and that's when I really found out about Maidstone. It's just suddenly this club, obviously the club's been going for years, but suddenly the ground had come about, the fans were loving it, and it was just such good support, and the team were better than that league. So it was something I went into, and we played some nice football, and I knew a few of the boys, obviously Darren was playing then, so it was a really good club to be a part of. And then I think the following season after Inverness, I came back and signed with Jay in the Ryman Premier. And looking back on all my years in football, it's tough to say which one was the best one. It's tough to, probably for me, it's tough to beat Inverness. But that year of Maidstone, we had such a good changing room, such a fiery changing room. And yeah, really, like how that one went down, ended up winning everything as well, really. Won the Ryman Premier, and it was an unbelievable experience. I think I wish in some ways I'd been my age now, because I was quite young at the time. I think I was only 22. And to be in that change room as a 22-year-old, I learned a lot. And again, like you said, not a case of fear, but when you've got Watty shouting at you, you've got all these players shouting at you, Rojo going crazy. And you just look at that dressing room. I almost wish that I'd experienced that a bit more of my age now, so I could be even more of a part of it. I felt like I was a part of it at the time, but I think I could have got even more involved had it been now.
And you're guaranteed the highlights every year, the Franny Collin winner against Stevenage gets wheeled out in your cross, of course.
Yeah, I think Franny gets a bit too much credit for that. It's always Happy Franny Day, it was the other day. Yeah. But that's definitely one of the biggest highlights in my career was that night. And obviously, yeah, just like the whole crowd coming on the pitch afterwards, I just remember everything for it. And being a Ryman Premier Club going into round two of the FA Cup was massive. And I think if you look at Mason's history in the FA Cup, I think ever since they've got into round one, haven't they, every year. So it's definitely, it's set something alight down the club, and the fans remember it. And I think the fans get the team going every year in the FA Cup.
I'm trying to think back to the Wrexham game that season, because if I remember rightly, was it the BBC picked you for an interview, and you were getting some stick from the rest of the players, weren't they? Because they chose the substitute to do the interview rather than the bloke who scored the winner because of the interland stuff and all that stuff.
I remember doing the interview with Jay. I think I knew I was subbing that game as well. So it was quite a strange interview because they were bigging me up, saying, obviously talking about the cross and things like this. And I knew that I wasn't going to be playing the game, but I still sort of got on with things and put my head down. It was a difficult game as well, because we ended up having a sending off, and it just didn't go the way to plan. I mean, maybe not having a sending off, and it could have been a different story, and we could have maybe got to round three, because it was quite a good opportunity. I think they were in Conference Premier at the time. So really, to be playing a team only two leagues above at round two, we had a bit of a chance. But Jay wasn't in the dugout, from what I remember. Jay was in the stands. So obviously he was shouting onto Watty and things like this, but not really being allowed to be involved. So it was a great experience, but it was it's probably a game that we look back on and maybe go, if that didn't happen, we might have even got into round three.
Yeah. Was the third spell, was that a frustrating one, given that, I remember when Jay got you back in and he said he thought you'd be a better player for the team in the Conference Prem rather than Conference Alpha, even Ryman Prem, and he sort of, because you had a great season at Concord, hadn't you? And it seemed like the time you'd really make a big impact, and then it didn't quite happen, did it?
I think it was one where we were actually doing really well at the start of the season. First game against York, I know we thought York were going to be like best team in the league, so we were almost quite happy with a 1-1 draw. I think we deserved the 3 points, but York got a goal back later on, and I think we put in some really good performances for the first sort of month or two, and then it went a little bit downhill, and a couple of points got dropped and things, and I think that's where the team started to change a bit, and that's where I was quite unlucky on me. But I think, still looking back on it, I think, as in the Conference Premier, that's the highest Maidstone's been in years. I think we were about 8th or 9th, and we looked like a solid team for the first 2 or 3 months. It's just it did go a bit downhill, and that's how football works. Is as soon as results stop going your way, you end up drifting out of the team, and it was one of them. I was trying to make an impact, but results weren't going our way again, and you can't always be coming on 2-3-0 down and expecting to try and turn the game around. So it was frustrating, yeah, but come January, I think Jay made the decision where it was, we've just got to stay in this league. It went from actually doing something in this league and we were doing really well to then it dropping off. And I remember Jay bringing in a few players that were going to keep us in that league, and I sort of noticed, do I want to keep coming off the bench? It's another one of those situations, and I think I would love to have hung about and stayed with them, but I've always said to myself, just need to be playing, no matter where you are. If you're always coming off the bench, it's not what you're out there to do. You're not playing football just to play sort of 10-15 minutes every week. It's like I said with the training. You've got to train for a purpose. You've got to be playing games. And talking to my academy boys now, you tell them they've got to go and play this lower standard. You've got to drop levels. You've got to drop your, almost in your head, where you think you should be. There's no problem with dropping down and making sure you're playing. You just need to get yourself in the frame. You need to just keep playing again. And that's one thing that I've always done. So obviously I went down a league and played in the Conference South again, and and just, yeah, tried getting the games in under the belt.
I think one of your last acts at Maidstone was the marriage proposal, wasn't it? I think it you was, left quite soon. Tell us about that, because I think the video has been viewed a lot of times on Twitter. And look, it took a hell of a lot of work to set it up, but it listen did, to this if anyone's looking for an idea to propose. Oh, yeah, it's a good story.
So it was one of, I wanted to make, I've been with Grace in school, so I wanted to make quite a big point of it. I wanted to do something special. Christmas time was a good time, especially up in London. So I'd agreed all my mates. I remember us being in the barn the night before. One of my mates got a barn. We ended up being in his barn and bought these 10 umbrellas. It might have been more than 10 umbrellas, actually. It was more than 10 umbrellas. And we were spray painting it, spray painting letters on each one. And it ended up saying, "Will you marry me, Grace?" And the plan was, obviously, to pop these umbrellas open and surprise her. It was all a little bit off the cuff. We knew we wanted to go up to London. I spoke to her parents and things. We had planned that. But on the way up, I remember coming off at Charing Cross, and we were almost rehearsing it around the corner, getting things right. And we chose to go to Covent Garden. Went down to Covent Garden, popped the umbrellas up, and as soon as the umbrellas came up, just the crowd went like that. And it went absolutely crazy. And the difficult thing that is, in London, they don't like a surge of people. They don't like loads of people being around. So I was ringing her sister, who was with her, and I told her to wait, because obviously we weren't set up. And then suddenly we were set up, and this crowd came in, and they just ordered two pizzas in Pizza Hut. So I was saying, you haven't got time for that. You've got to get it straight away, because we're getting kicked out. And they've ended up come running over. I think that's when she clocked something was going on, because you wouldn't just be sitting in Pizza and then have to sprint out of the restaurant to get somewhere. So they've ended up coming sprinting out, and the crowd was so big that you couldn't see what was going on from the back. So she's coming with her sister, and they're like, "Oh, what's going on here?" And she's going, "What's going on here? I don't know." And her sister's trying to work it out and going, "How can I get her through without making obvious?" In the end, she starts just shoving her through and pushed all the way down. It was in Covent Garden, where there's the square where it drops down, and you see all the umbrellas saying, "Will you marry me, Grace?" And obviously, yeah, from then and ever since, we've always had a good Christmas Eve. I think it's a really good time for it. And she was completely gone. Yeah, she was all over the place and didn't expect it as much. But yeah, definitely one of the best ideas I've probably ever come up with.
It's the standard, that one.
I've put a bit of pressure on everyone else in the family, but yeah, it was a really good moment. And like I said, we celebrate Christmas Eve every year now, so it's all good.
Definitely. Inverness was one we wanted to chat to you about, because you had a good time there, didn't you? Hit the top of the Scottish Premiership, worked under Terry Butch, obviously England legend, great character. Tell us about the time up there.
I think Inverness was probably the best year for me in football. I think it was... At first, you're thinking, you're looking at it on the maps and it says 10 hours to get up there, and you're searching what's near it, and there's absolutely nothing near it. But all of the players were in the same boat. A lot of them were from England, different parts of England, and we were all up there living together. And you felt like a family, and you ended up, you see more of them than your family. You see the players every day. And just the lifestyle up there was brilliant. You feel a lot more relaxed. Obviously, some of the views and everything was unbelievable. And just... the whole town's had a very togetherness. You end up talking to the fans and everything all the time. It was a really, really good time of my life, and we loved it out there. All the boys got along with each other, and it's probably one of the only times it almost didn't matter if you were playing or weren't playing. You were just such a good bunch of players that all just training with each other, playing with each other every day, going out for lunch every day, going out on a Saturday night together. It was definitely one of them. And I remember, obviously, everyone thinks of Butcher as this really scary man, and the first time I met him, he seemed about 2 foot taller than me, and just thinking I was completely looking up at him. But he was one of the nicest people, really genuine people. Definitely, he's got an aggressive side to him, where he can get angry. I've got a couple of stories on that. But he also, at the same time, he understood player management. I remember he pulled me in one time, where I hadn't played. He pulled me into the office and just said, "Keep doing this," you know. And it was good to hear that from a manager, that you don't fear, but at the same time, you know he's got that side to him where he gets angry. And I think best moment for that was, we went to Parkhead away. We were 2-0 up with about 3 minutes to go, and obviously this is at Celtic. The whole Celtic fans spent the whole game cheering Maradona and just constantly on Butcher's back and things like this, because obviously where he was a Rangers man himself. And we ended up letting in a goal 1 minute to go, and then letting in another goal, being 2-2, and he's completely lost. We're in the change room, everyone's head down. I've never seen a change room so much where you just don't want eye contact, head down, and as he's walking through, you end up seeing his fist come through the wall. Just completely smashed the wall in, and there's still a hole there now. And it was just one of them, you're like, oh no, and he's coming, he's thrown, I remember he'd thrown water tanks at players. And he just, the best thing was, and it proves how much respect we had for him, and the deserved respect, he'd throw stuff at players, things like this, probably deserving to at times, because he was angry, we'd just lost games and stuff like that, but not at any time did anyone reply to him. And that summed it up, really. No one would look at him and say anything back, and it's just straight away, because we all had the respect for him. We all understood it. We're like, right, just take it, and then we'll move on. Monday morning, we'll be fine again. And, it was just... But like I said, he was, as a manager, I actually felt... I know from there on, he didn't have the greatest of career. I think I was quite... he went off to Hibs, and we'd sort of spoke about maybe me going to Hibs because I wasn't playing as much under the new manager. And then he ends up getting fired from Hibs. And then it's a shame, because I would have always said he would be the right person to be the England manager, because he's just got so much passion. He'd be the right person. When we went through those spells with England where we didn't look like we wanted to play for England, I think he would have been the right people to get them going, because you look at his histories and you look at the way he wants his players, he'll always get the most out of his players. I think pre-season with him, we spent maybe 9 days without touching a football. But I've never been fitter for it in my life. So there's methods to it. Obviously, nowadays, I don't think you could get away with that, because boys would just be turning and going, no, I want to kick a ball, we want to play football. But it was definitely, like I said, it was the fittest I think I've ever been. So it did work, and we bought into it.
Was he one, when he launched someone, would it be forgotten the next day, or did he sort of keep it going?
Yeah, no, it would be forgotten. It would be. One of the good ones was we went out, and after a pre-season game, we had our team night out, and we went out on a Saturday. And it's quite funny in the town, because they've got Ross County as well. So they've got these two big rivalries, and there would be times in the town where people didn't like you because you were a footballer, or you played for Inverness, and they didn't like you because of that. So I remember the one night, a bit of a problem all kicked off, ended up having the captain arrested. Captain ended up getting arrested, and we had a community day the next day. So we've turned up, Terry Butcher's there and everything, and the captain hasn't turned up, and we were just thinking, who's he going to ask, when's he going to say it? And we thought, has he even spoken to him? Like, because obviously he's in this cell at the moment. Has he spoken to him to say where he is? So we had no idea. We've sort of left it to a bit more the more experienced players to maybe talk to him. And he seemed angry all day, didn't talk to any of us, and we're like, this community day couldn't have gone any worse. We're all hungover. The manager's not looking at us, captain's still in prison, and we ended up turning up on a Monday morning, and you hear him walking down, no one's saying a word, we're just sitting in the change room, just, again, no eye contact, wait for him to come in, barges through the door, scribbles something massive on the whiteboard, everyone's that intimidated, they still don't look at the whiteboard, and he's just, the first thing he says, right, who was out Saturday night? And we just thought, right, got to stand up, so 9 or 10 of us stood up. And he's just gone, I love it. He's just gone, I love you all. And then he points to the whiteboard and he's written teamwork on it. Oh, and it's just so, it's one of them, like, you're thinking he's going to go absolutely mental. We thought, right, we've got to stand up to this. But he's ended up applauding it. And he said, look, this happens. I love your team spirit. You all went out together. You all backed the captain up and things like that. So it was all good. But yeah, it was just, and that just sums up what type of manager he was. He wanted a good changing room. And that's something that I believe in. A lot of managers I play for believe in that. I think if you get a good changing room, then it's definitely it helps out your team.
And he took you to the top of the league as well, didn't he? That shouldn't be overlooked.
Yeah, exactly,
you know, Rangers,
yeah.
Celtic, Hibs, Hearts, yeah. All those big clubs, and he took you to the top of that table.
Yeah, and it's funny, because it felt like that year we were just unstoppable, and it was a bit of a shame that he left us for Hibs, because you understand it, Inverness, they don't get loads of fans. They get a good amount of fans and they're all from the town, but you're not going to get loads more because the catchment area is not massive. And obviously he took the job at Hibs, where it was a bigger club. I felt like he might be able to do more with it, but maybe if he looked back on it, could he have finished the year with Inverness and see if he'd have got Inverness to their highest ever position, taking Inverness through Europa League and things like this. So I think maybe if he looks back on it and says, right, I could have done this, maybe wouldn't have gone to Hibs, because it didn't quite work out as well as he wanted it to at Hibs. But again, it's decisions in football. You never know which one's the right one, do you? It was a shame for me, like I said, a shame for quite a few of us, because we got along so well. And when a new manager comes in, he changed it up, and we didn't see as much of the ball under him. But it was, again, an experience. I think I only played under him 4 or 5 months, Terry Butcher. But it's just, the change room was great. Atmosphere was unbelievable. Again, like I said, probably the fittest I've ever been, most I've ever wanted to play. And it was just, yeah, it was an unbelievable time.
You're listening to the KM Football Podcast.
I always think of you, Ben, as a left winger, someone who's always played down the left. You did, though, get moved into a more central role. Was that right? And that's been quite recent, hasn't it?
I think there's been times when at Inverness I actually got moved to being a forward. So just, there were times when it happens, and then because I'm left-footed, because I had a bit of pace and things like this, because I could cross a ball, it always ends up happening, going, right, let's play Ben on the left. And because when I was young, I was brought up as a winger, I do understand that position well. I know when I need to be back, where I need to be back. I'm not one of them wingers who's just going to stay up there and wait for the ball to come to me. I'll go and get it and things. So I do understand that position well, and I get when managers are moving there. But I think I've probably, looking at my career, I've probably got the most out of myself playing through the middle, playing in the 10. It happened at Concord Rangers when I went to there. They've started on the left. It was going all right, and then they put me in the hole, and then I just started scoring goals and started creating chances and things. So it's one of them. It depends how you want to play. It depends what manager you got. Some managers want a massive forward and then a really, really fast forward. Some managers want two big forwards, cross the ball into them, so then I go out to the left. It just depends what type of way. And I think as a player, I'll run beyond. I'll run off the player. I'll read if the player's going to head it or not win it, and just try and pick up second balls. So, and it was good at Concord, that's what we did. I played up front with Steve Corley, and I knew every time where he was going to head it, how he was going to head it, so I'd be able to judge that, I'd be able to get onto that, and it worked quite well. And it's a funny one, like you said, when you end up having a left foot, you automatically, because there's not as many left footed players, you automatically go out to that left hand side. And it's funny, I'd be happy to play in the 10, I'd be happy to play on the left. It just depends what way the team want to play and how I can fit in.
You always thought of yourself as a striker then, in your head almost, rather than a winger?
Yeah, I think you get a lot more out of scoring goals. You get a lot more out of, in terms of the feeling. I've spent probably the whole of my career has been setting up goals. And when you get the opportunity to go and score a goal, you do get that little bit of extra buzz, or you feel like, right, I'm going to go again now, I'm going to score another goal. So I've always wanted to be in and around the area to score the goals. But I'm quite level-headed. If one manager wants me to be this player, I'll focus on that and I'll be that type of player for them. I think if you look at almost every club I've been at, I've probably adapted to being a bit of a different player. I wouldn't say any club I've been at have been the same style. I think like with Dartford last year, it was a lot of staying wide, crossing the ball in. And when you get that in your head, that becomes part of your game, and you get used to doing that. And it was working, so you carry on doing that, rather than when I was maybe running inside more and trying to get shots off or trying to score more goals. So it just depends on how you wanted to play.
It's amazing to think as well that you're still only 27 and that you've actually put so much. You've done, you've actually done so much as well, though, haven't you, in the career so far?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely want to try and get as many non-league appearances under my belt. I'd like to try and get over 500. Little ambitions. I set myself little targets like that. I want to get a certain amount of goals, a certain amount of assists. And it's tough to say now. Never been superstitious, and I've always said this. So if I ever do get injured, then it won't be because of this. But I've never had an injury. So at sort of 27 to be doing it, I understand. I'm not saying I never will have an injury. Of course, anything can happen in football. I've seen some of the greatest players who are constantly fit that go and get injured or be out for spells, and that's football, and you've just got to take that and sort of play with that. That's the card you've been dealt. So it's one of them. In my head, I'd love to say I'll play on for another 10 years. I feel like fitness wise I can. I'm always, every club I've been at in the pre-season, I've won every run. So that's another target I set myself. Come next pre-season, I've got to do that again. It gets harder because I've started noticing my body over off-season spells. You want to have a rest. You need to have a rest. But at the same time, if you want to keep your level of fitness up and you want to go and win all the runs in pre-season, then you've got to start putting the effort in. And it becomes harder. Obviously, when you were younger, you could do that day after day after day and not cause any strain to your body. It's just more a case of managing myself now and making sure I'm getting the most out of myself and keeping my fitness levels as high as they can be.
It's interesting what you say about staying fit. And the two things spring to mind with that. One is, does that mean you're hurdling these challenges from these mean right-backs or centre-halves that are trying to chop you in half as you're going down the wing? And secondly, is there some sort of pre-match ritual that you're going through? Are you doing some stretches that other people aren't doing out? I mean, is it, you know, because you're not having any muscle injuries in that sense?
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, I was always a runner, so I was running the national championships when I was under 17, so I think that's definitely helped. I've always had a stamina levels that have kept me going, and I guess was lucky that my muscles could take it. In terms of pre-match routines, I do the same thing. I'm not, again, like I said, I'm not superstitious, but it's funny how as I've got older, I almost prepare exactly the same way. Like I'll eat beans and toast at the same time on a Saturday for 11:30. I'll have one Red Bull before a game, just really like weird things like this. I'll have the exact same kit on that I wear in every game. And that almost got a bit too far because I was still wearing the same Under Armour shorts that I was wearing at Inter Milan for 9 years. And it ended up to the point last year, I was like, I've got to get rid of these. So you end up preparing the same way. And I think you then feel right for the game. There's been games where silly things, like maybe I've done one thing differently the night before, I've eaten something differently the night before, and then you're just like, it affects your head, it mentally affects you. It might not affect your game whatsoever, but you then start thinking differently, and then you start thinking, oh, I didn't do this, oh, I didn't do that. And it's become a thing, even just like the silly things, like I wrap tape around my wrists, and again, that's just because I've always done it, and I'm sure I could play one game without it and do absolutely fine. But in my head, I'm thinking, oh, I haven't done this, I haven't done that. And it just doesn't set yourself up for the game. So I always prepare the same way. I always prepare so that I'm completely, fully prepared 100%. And then you can focus on the game and try and get the most out of yourself then.
Talk about your work in the academy now. At what point did you realise that you wanted to get into the coaching side of things as well? Because, I mean, you've had so many great coaches tell you what to do, and that you must have picked up so much over the years.
Oh yeah, definitely. I've always wanted to be in football, like ever since I was young. Football's been everything. So when football became a bit more part time, it was right, coaching's what I'm gonna do. So I've even gained quite a good bit of experience out of coaching. I've done a lot of school stuff, still do some school stuff now, and then developed it onto academy things. I've got Corinthians under 18 team. Obviously the Dartford Academy boys, so it's something that I'm always want to be in. Not going to say I'm always going to be in, you know how this business works, it's a bit cutthroat. So it's something that I'll always push myself to be in. But like you said, if I look back at my managers, I've learned something off every single one of them. I can't say I'm going to be the joint of all of them, the best coach ever, but I will try and take in all the good stuff from them and try and think what I liked. So it's like we're saying with Terry Butcher, good changer, and Flan was the same. Flan ought to have played probably 150 games for Flan. He'd be the same thing. He's a good man manager, he'd talk to you well, always try and get the most out of you and things like that. And he'd always want a good changer, he'd always want everyone to give on a night out. If I look at Danny Cowley, like, he's someone that obviously as a coach myself, I've got to look up towards because his career is beyond, like, you just can't talk about it. You just can't get your head around how well he's done. He's gone from Essex Senior League to Championship and getting Managers of the Month in the Championship. So, and one thing that he always did and he got the most out of me was just, like I said, it was positivity, it was energetic. Them two on the side would never stop. And then in the warm-up, they'd never stop. They wouldn't sit off it. So I've sort of tried taking that into my management style and things like that. I'd always try and get the most out of it. And I think it's worked this year for the Academy Boys. I think if you asked them, one thing that I've done is I've tried making everything energetic, everything for them to always be like activated before the game and things. And we come up with a few of these busy quotes and things like that. And I laugh at it at the same time, but it's what Danny Cowley did and it's what worked. Every other team would laugh at him saying it, but the team that played for him worked really well for him. And if it's got him that far, it clearly does work. And then obviously other managers, you take as much from them as you can, even with Tony, for the 4 or 5 weeks played under him, just that level of respect. You've got to try and work on all these different things to get the right things out of the players and to try and push them on and get the best results. So I can't say I'm going to be the best of all of those managers. I can't say I'm going to be able to do it, but you can definitely take on those things and try and get the best out of your team from it.
Can you tell as a player maybe within a week or 2 weeks of working for a manager whether you're going to get on, whether they're your type of manager, whether there's a bond? Or do you tell before you even sign for the club, can you see?
Yeah, I think you can. I think some managers like types of players. So obviously, if you've spoken well to the managers, you're quite excited about and things like that. So I think there's probably only been the one manager up in Scotland where it was John Hughes came in. He's probably the only manager. Every other manager I've bought into, and I've spoken to them before previously and things like that. And I felt like I can understand what they're going to do. I can understand this. So it's going to be different, but I can try and build around this. I think the only one was John Hughes because he came in and he didn't know my name. And you're like, if you don't know my name, you're clearly not that. I remember him in training just going like this to me, just kept clicking, pointing at me. And I was like, it's Ben. just thinking, if you've done this, I've been playing under Terry Butcher, but you're doing this now, then you get that feeling straight away, right, clearly you're not one of his players. You do get a feel for things like that. And again, that comes back to where we're saying you end up training for no reason, and you get a bit down, you get a bit negative because you feel like the manager doesn't want you, which is difficult. It's definitely difficult to take. But I mean, it's even if I was to look at, I probably didn't play loads at Maidstone, probably didn't play as much as I would have wanted to, but I got along with Jay really well. I got along with him really well. I always coached with him. I always spoke to him well. He'd always speak to me well. I'd never cause a problem if he was dropping me, because sometimes I agreed with him and I understood it. So it's one of them, you can still, even if you're not playing, you still buy into a manager, you can still accept what a manager's saying and understand him and go along with it. And it's one of them in football, they're the boss for that time, aren't they? They're the ones in charge. If it was a single, like solo sport, like if I'm playing golf, out there I'm playing golf, it's all down to me. But you've got to remember, football is down to so many different things, where obviously it can be a manager, it can be a chairman, it can be other players around you. So it's one of them in football. You can't let it beat yourself too much up, because there can be external things that can cause the situations.
We've mentioned a lot of famous names, haven't we, over the last hour or so. One we haven't is Ronaldo, of course.
Yeah.
And you've done a bit of work with him. And tell us about that. Is it body double? And
I've Mike Delaney, as a coach for the Skills Academy, I've coached for 10 years. I used to do it a lot more and always be within schools, and it's something that I've really enjoyed since I took over the academy. I haven't done as much of it, but he was a guy that he does all the football choreography and adverts for Adidas and things like this, and he's got me onto a lot of adverts over the time, and I've managed to meet a lot of different players, and the first one was Ronaldo, because obviously I had a little bit of a resemblance to him. I looked up to him obviously when I was young. A Man United fan, and he was scoring all the goals for Man United, so he was a player that I looked up to, and it was I was lucky enough to become the body double for him for a Portuguese bank advert, and went down to meet him, and that was something. We're saying that was surreal, that was absolutely mental, because where I'd looked up to him so much, and I was a winger, he was a winger, he was playing for Man United, he was Ballon d'Or winner, and I remember just catching a glimpse of him at the time, and he double looked me and he went, you look like me. And obviously I've been dressed to look like him and everything, so I would have hoped I did. But it was quite funny, and I did kick ups with him, and he's done a few adverts with Ronaldo since, and it's not the same anymore, because let's be honest, Ronaldo's this absolutely big, not big time himself, maybe he is, but he's this really big character within football. He doesn't have the time to do as much. When he was at United, he had a little bit more time and things, and he'd come and do kick-ups with you. He'd be there. If I remember that advert we did, he was there for about 3.5 hours. Whereas now, it's if you're seeing a player come to an advert, they're there for 10, 15 minutes. But the best thing about that day was it always gets leaked that Ronaldo's about. It was like, right, Ronaldo's in this gym in Manchester. And you looked outside and all the press were there. And they thought, right, how are we going to get rid of this press? So obviously I was dressed as Ronaldo. They've got all umbrellas around me so they can sort of get glimpses of me. And we've gone under these umbrellas and we've run off and they've got all this press running after up the road after me. Ronaldo just walks out the back door, just walks off, gets in his car and goes. And then we sort of stop, they turn around, they start turning for each other, actually, that's not Ronaldo. So that was quite a good one. But I've done quite a few adverts for him of where I'm left footed. I've done Gareth Bale, Ozil, Robin Van Persie, and I was lucky enough to meet a lot of these players. And it was an avenue that I'm interested in, football adverts and things like that, but it doesn't come up every week. Do you know what I mean? There's one big football advert a year, maybe two or three. So it wasn't something that was a full-time thing. But if I ever get the call from Mike and he says, right, we've got this advert for you, come and be Dybala or something like that, or anything, then straight away I'm like, right, yeah, I'll come and do it. And you get a chance to meet these players, you get a chance to work in a different side of football, and something I've always enjoyed.
Well, are they all right with you, the players, and do you get to sort of have a chat with them? And
yeah, there's some players that haven't had time for you. There's some players that have. Like Martial was really good. We did the Man United advert. Martial was good to us. He was another one having a kick about. Funniest one was Diego Costa, because when people look at him and they think he's crazy on the pitch, they don't see half of it. When he's off the pitch, it was absolutely something else. He was taking cameras down, he was taking lenses out while he's meant to be shooting, he was slide tackling the director, and it's just like, this is why it's all going on. It's just like, this is a grown man who you see playing football week in, week out, scoring goals for Chelsea and Spain, and he's just booting balls everywhere while things are going on, ruining every set. And you couldn't get your head around it. And the funniest thing was with him, he never learned English. He could never speak English while he was over here. But he'd do interviews and he'd do all the advert stuff. And the director spoke to him, he'd just go back and go, blah, 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 blah. And he just, every time the director would talk to him, he'd go back and talk in that formal language. He'd just make up his own language and talk back to him. You just think, this guy is completely off it. And you look back, I think it was Conte that got rid of him, wasn't it? I think, and it's just, you completely understand why. What I saw of him was, I couldn't get my head around how he was even a grown man, let alone this Chelsea centre forward who was one of the best centre forwards in the Premier League.
Golf was another thing.
Yeah.
Where are you with that? You playing much? Because you reached very high standard, didn't you?
Yeah, it was another point where I went into part-time football and I thought, I've got to do something else. And I was playing well at golf at the time and I started my PGA. And that was something that was... It was a good idea at the time. I then realised I didn't want to work in a golf shop, didn't want to do that whole side, the whole retail side of it. I just wanted to play golf. So I still play a lot. Managed to get my handicap down to +3 at Addington Palace. So it's a course that I know very well. Probably not that standard of golfer, but at Addington Palace, when I go around, I know the greens, I know the course. And it's something that I like to try and do as much as possible. I like to try and play whenever I can. And it's just, yeah, it's a different sport. Like I said earlier, it's an individual sport. It's you're out there on your own. If you're playing badly, you're playing badly. Do you know what I mean? If it's completely down to you. And it's a little bit too long. I'm sure my wife will tell you that. If it's a 4 or 5 hour day. So you don't really have the. It's not one of them with football. You can go and play a game of football. You'll be back in a couple of hours, but you just can't beat the social side to it. Going having a round with your mates, going to the bar with your mates afterwards, and just if you've played badly, you've played badly. You've played well, you've played well. You're a good bit of competition, but it's a game that I've gone and played all around the world playing golf, and it's something that I'm always going to do, always want to do. And not saying it's something after football. It could be if I end up really stepping on and really playing well, then obviously there's a chance, you never know. But at the moment I'm just enjoying it, and I'm playing in local competitions, and it's something that I'd like to do outside of football.
Onto the quick fire questions. Best goal you've ever scored, Ben?
Probably the Ryman Cup for Concord Rangers. It was a free kick in the last minute and it got us through to extra time. We ended up winning the cup. It was at Maidstone as well, so it was against Dulwich Hamlet, so it's definitely a memorable one.
Favourite ground you've played at? This has opened up a lot of possibilities, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a few big names I could say. I think I've got to say Tranmere, because the Tranmere game for Maidstone in the Conference Prem, we were winning 1-0. You're playing in this massive ground, and the noise when it went 2-1 was ridiculous. But I remember playing in the game thinking, these fans are so loud, playing on the pitch going, these fans are crazy. And then I'm thinking, why are they chanting my name? And then I've looked over and thought, hang on, that's the Maidstone fans I can hear. So the Maidstone fans that year at Tranmere sort of outsung all these thousands of Tranmere fans in such a big stadium, and it just echoed. It was, yeah, that was probably one of the best ones.
Funniest teammate, or maybe teammates? I think there might be a few down the years.
It's definitely quite a few. After thinking at time of change right now, Jay Fawkes is quite a good one. I've played him at Ebbsfleet as well. He's always an entertaining value. Probably Marley Watkins at Inverness, because it was just you just didn't know what was going to happen with him. He used to, every day we'd drive into Inverness along the A9. It was just like the motorway coming in. And dual carriageway, he'd come off at every roundabout and come back on. And he'd do that two roundabouts on the spin. So he'd actually come down off the dual carriageway to go to the roundabout and then come back on the dual carriageway. And we used to say to him, why are you doing that? You just stay on the road, stay on the same road and you get to the ground. He's like, no. If you come off there, you then come back onto this road and that takes you to the ground. And you're just thinking there was no getting through to him. But he was such a good character as well, and he was great entertainment.
Best training ground moment?
Scottville, we said it already. Scottville, Nutmeg and Vieira. That's the only thing that comes to mind, to be fair. But yeah, definitely that.
The biggest footballer bandits on the golf course?
Footballer bandits. Coyley's got to be one. He's a good scratch golfer, and me and him play at scratch. Well, we play against each other scratch, but really I think his handicap's 5 or 6, and then I'm +3 at the moment, and that makes out there's 9 shots between us, but there's not. And he used to beat me scratch quite a bit when we first started playing. It really get in my head. We've turned it around over the years a little bit, but I'm not sure I've ever beaten him handicap, because somehow he gets 40 points every week and I'm sort of struggling to get near 36. So he's definitely one of the biggest bandits to play with. It's good when you come against players who say they're 28 handicappers. There's quite a few of them out there, and you just, if they turn off on the day, they'll absolutely smash it. But the one that comes to my head is Coyley.
Do you still have Jamie Redknapp's number?
I do. I think he's got a different number because I keep ringing it and he's not answering. No, I do still have his number. It's one of them, same sort of thing. I've never been a starstruck person. If he rings me, I'll answer the phone, but I'm never going to give him a call unless I absolutely have to.
Ben, it's been absolutely brilliant. We thought you'd be a good guest, and so you've proved it. We've really enjoyed the last hour or so of your stories of Italian football and non-league football, and even Scottish football as well. That's probably a first for the podcast. Yeah. So really enjoyed it. Thanks very much for coming in.
No, thank you very much. Really enjoyed it as well. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the KM Football Podcast. Click subscribe at Audio Boom and iTunes, and keep up to date with the latest stories at kentonline.co.uk.